The hearing will come to order. Today, the Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations is holding a hearing entitled Examining the Olympic Community's Ability to Protect Athletes from Sexual Abuse.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Earlier this year, USA Gymnastics team doctor Larry Nassar was found guilty of abusing young athletes. Hundreds of women and girls eventually stepped forward to say Nassar had abused them. Last week, Michigan State settled with 332 of those victims. But that's not the extent of the problems facing the U.S. Olympic Committee. Yesterday, six key leaders of the USOC and national sports governing bodies testified before the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations. Suzanne Lyons, the acting head of the United States Olympic Committee, was front and center alongside the heads of USA Gymnastics, Swimming, Taekwondo, and Volleyball, and Shelley Fole, head of the U.S. Center for Safe Sport. Sexual abuse and alleged cover-ups have been reported in all of these organizations.
There appears to be a history of the USOC knowing about allegations of sexual abuse and doing nothing.
Whether the culture of winning above all else increases the risk of athlete abuse.
I think probably for every one of these cases of sexual abuse, someone knew about it and didn't say anything.
No response whatsoever.
It's horrific.
If a failing background check doesn't lead to terminating someone's membership, what would? I don't like that question.
Protect the coach and not protect the athlete.
You know, every day that I wake up, I think about how do we make sure as an entity that we are doing everything we can to protect our athletes.
Lindsay Gibbs is a sports reporter at Think Progress and co-host of the feminist sports podcast, Burn It All Down. How's it going, Lindsay?
It's going good. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Thanks for being with us. Now, you were at the hearing. Was there a general sense that some accountability was being skirted? Because that's kind of what it sounds like from the clips we're hearing.
Absolutely. There was a lot of, we're working on that, we'll get on that, but not a lot of concrete action being taken. And it was an incredibly frustrating hearing, especially for survivors who were in the audience.
And Suzanne Lyons is at the head of all this as the acting CEO of the USOC. How did she get into that position?
So Suzanne Lyons took over as the interim CEO at the end of February 2018, so just a couple of months ago, after Scott Blackmon, who was the head of the USOC during most of these scandals, if for lack of a better word, he resigned. He said it was for health reasons, but there were many, many calls for him to step down, including from senators. And at that point, they put Lyons in charge. She is a longtime USOC board member, though. So this is not someone who's coming in from the outside. She has been there and she has known about a lot of this abuse.
And I'm wondering, I think the type of abuse that most Americans are familiar with, or at least we've heard of, falls clearly within the gymnastics sports. But there is abuse alleged in other parts of swimming, taekwondo, volleyball. Can you give us a sense in these other sports of what types of abuse we're seeing?
Yeah, I think you're seeing all kinds. Unfortunately, sports, especially with, you know, youth sports, are a breeding ground for predators because the amount of accessibility that you have to children, the amount of trust that goes into those relationships, and, you know, the physicality of sport in general. A lot of what we see, especially in swimming, and you see this in taekwondo, is relationships, quote unquote, between coaches and trainers and authority figures who are predominantly male, and then athletes in their teens who are young. And a lot of these relationships end up lasting for years, but they start when these athletes are children, 13, 14, 15. And it's been so widely accepted within swimming, within volleyball, within all of these sports. It's been so widely accepted that it was just seen as the norm. And there were no, the USOC did not completely make it against the rules for there to be relationships between athletes and coaches until the beginning of 2014.
And specific incidences outside of Larry Nassar, for example, when we're thinking about volleyball, there's a story about Rick Butler, right? What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so Rick Butler was banned for life in 1995 due to sex abuse, which sounds like the right thing. And then all of a sudden, Rick Butler in appealed the decision, as the coaches often do. In 2000, it was overturned, and he didn't receive another lifetime ban until earlier this year. And that was 17 more years where he was abusing. And he is still, I just found this out, but he is still showing up to a lot of events. He's transferred ownership of his club to his wife, but he's still showing up at a lot of these competitions. His victims are still running into him on a daily basis. There's still no oversight.
And what about the Lopez brothers in Taekwondo? What can you tell us about them?
Oh, it's just a horrific. I mean, the two of them, so they were the faces of USA Taekwondo. The U.S. Olympic Committee, NBC, Taekwondo, all used them as the stars of that sport. One was a coach and one was the multiple Olympic champion. And for decades, they preyed on and abused young women within Taekwondo. We're talking physical abuse. We're talking sexual abuse. A lot of this happened on trips that were paid for by the U.S. Olympic Committee that were at sanctioned U.S. Olympic Committee events, including the Olympics themselves. And when women brought these allegations up, they had to jump through so many hoops to find some sort of justice. They were often publicly shamed. They were pushed out of the sport. And yet the Lopez brothers were allowed to continue to reign. In 2016, an investigation into Stephen Lopez was actually suspended. So there, he was under a safe sport investigation. The USOC and the USA Taekwondo suspended that investigation so that he could compete at the 2016 Rio Olympics.
So in the introduction to the piece, I mentioned the head of Safe Sport, Shelley Fole. Can you tell us what Safe Sport is, first of all?
Sure. So the Safe Sport was essentially set up as an office that can investigate these allegations of sexual abuse within all Olympic sports. So there are 48 separate national governing bodies, which are, you know, the individual sports, skating, speed skating, you know, Taekwondo, 48 of them underneath the Olympic Committee's umbrella. So now any allegations of sexual abuse within those individual sports are supposed to go up the line to the U.S. Center of Safe Sport, and they're supposed to do the investigation, much like a Title IX office would within college.
So Shelley Fole said this about the sexual abuse reports the organization has been getting in, and I want to play a clip from that hearing yesterday.
Let me put it into perspective for you. This time last year, we were getting 20 to 30 reports per month. Now, we're getting 20 to 30 reports per week.
What explains the uptick in those reports? Can you give us a sense?
Yeah, I think it's two things. It's the Me Too movement, which, of course, elevated the national conversation around sexual abuse. And it's also, though, the attention that the Larry Nassar survivors were able to bring to this attention when they spoke up at Nassar's sentencing hearings in January, and over 200 of them gave victim impact statements. And that really changed the tone of all of this. None of these organizations have done anything until the media scrutiny on them has reached a fever pitch.
There was another interesting exchange. Representative Buddy Carter, a Republican of Georgia, questioned the USA Gymnastics CEO, Carrie Perry, about former coach William McCabe. And he was accused of molesting gymnasts and sentenced to 30 years in prison in 2007. Let's take a listen.
Do you ever do background checks on any of your coaches like this?
First of all, let me say that.
Now, do you ever do background checks on any of your coaches like this?
So
it's a yes or no question.
There are background checks that are being done currently.
Did you do background checks on him? This sexual predator who is in jail, in prison for 30 years, did you do background checks on him?
I was not there. I can't answer that.
Well, find out who was there, because I need an answer to it, okay?
Yes, sir.
Background checks are something that one would imagine, or at least would hope, is a pretty basic vetting requirement for coaches at this level. Why is there such an inability to answer that question?
Well, the truth is, none of these policies and procedures were followed for decades by a lot of these organizations, including USA Gymnastics. There's been a lot of, we don't want to admit that this is a problem within our systems, because then we are held liable for it. So for decades, you've seen these organizations under the Olympic Committee umbrella really shirk their responsibility to protect these young athletes. And that includes things like background checks. you know, Buddy Carter, he received a lot of criticism from some of his fellow congressmen and congresswomen yesterday for the tone he struck. But I thought his anger was completely justified. Just because Kerry Perry is now the CEO of USA Gymnastics. She did just start that position in December 2017. But the case he's talking about, the case against Bill McCabe, a former USA Gymnastics certified coach, that's actually the case that the Indianapolis Star originally reported on that ended up leading to women coming forward about Larry Nassar. That is a very well-known case, and the fact that Kerry Perry should automatically know all of the facts and be able to answer all the questions about that. The case is settled. They can't say that we're still in litigation. There should be full transparency there.
And you've also talked to victims who were present at the hearing. What did they have to say about a lot of these exchanges?
Yeah, one of the victims I talked to was Jessica Howard, who was one of Nassar's survivors, who's been a very vocal advocate. And she was incredibly frustrated. She felt that a lot of the leaders of the Olympic sports got away very, very easily. They weren't forced to answer many yes or no questions, like you just heard Carter try to do to Perry. They weren't forced to give concrete timelines. And there was kind of a degree of civility throughout the proceedings that was a little bit puzzling, I think. And probably not well deserved for these individuals who are leading right now. At the end, a lot of people echoed Representative Debbie Dingell's, who's from Michigan. The end of the hearing, she kind of said that she was frustrated, and she said, "I don't hear any urgency from any of you. Like, why should we believe you? There's no urgency."
That was some really powerful testimony. In fact, why don't we take a listen to that and then hear your thoughts on that?
There have been far too many incidences and allegations of sexual misconduct in sport, including allegations involving individuals associated with each of the national governing bodies before us today. And honestly, I'm not reassured by your testimony because I don't hear a sense of urgency. I keep hearing, well, we're going to do it, we're going to get to this, we're going to do it. Well, who are these young people that need help that aren't getting there?
Lindsay, you can hear how frustrated Dingell is there. Tell us more about that exchange.
Yeah, Jessica really pointed and echoed Dingell's sentiments that there is no urgency. And that's what's missing. That's what's missing from all of this. All of these changes should have been made already. There should be no more excuses. None of the fact that any of this is a problem is not a surprise to anyone. And really, the time for words is gone, and it's time to see these leaders take concrete action.
Lindsay Gibbs is a sports reporter at Think Progress and co-host of the sports and feminism podcast, Burn It All Down. Lindsay, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Got a comment for the show? Hit us up on our Facebook page. Tweet us at The Takeaway or leave us a voicemail at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Your ideas and takes are a huge part of who we are. Let us know what you're thinking about. This is The Takeaway.
This week on The Takeaway, we started a conversation about homeschooling. In the wake of another school shooting, we heard from some of you that you're either homeschooling your kids or considering it. But some of you called in with different reasons.
My name's Melody. I recently withdrew my son from high school. In our case, we don't have to be subjected to casual racism and drug exposure. So we both believe we made the right choice.
Takeaway listener Melody Cunningham balances work and homeschooling her 14-year-old son in Weymouth, Massachusetts. And she's part of a larger trend of Black families in the United States who are choosing to take their kids out of public schools for a better or safer place to learn. We got Melody back on the line to talk about why she made the choice.
My son was experiencing a cavalier attitude towards his casual racism at his high school, and he had just had enough. We had broached the idea of homeschooling prior to the incidents, and he just decided that it was time and he was ready to get out of school and that I could do a better job, possibly.
And so can you give us a sense of some of the examples of some of the incidences that he had experienced?
For sure. Casual use of the N-word, as well as him in particular sitting in a world history class whereby a student said out loud that slavery shouldn't have been abolished.
And we also know that there's data that shows that Black students are more severely disciplined than white students in schools. Wondering if that factored into your decision to homeschool, or whether the threat of violence, i.e. school shootings, was another reason why you, in addition to the racism that you're saying your son experienced.
Oh, absolutely. We had already witnessed and been, I'll say, victims of what I perceive to be inequity. And as far as disciplinary actions, the student who said what I told you didn't receive any sort of disciplinary action, whereby my son said something to another student and he was suspended immediately. That, and definitely threats of violence, that has given me a peace of mind knowing that that aspect has been eliminated. We don't have to worry about that. And, you know, he feels as though there are several ticking time bombs in his school alone who could quite possibly be capable of the sort of violence we've seen in the 22 other school shooting cases this year.
You mentioned also history, and I'm curious to know what that looks like when you're homeschooling an African-American student.
Oh, this was an excellent opportunity, and I'm now so glad that I did it, because I have the opportunity to teach him a lot more than what is standard in the schools, whereby Black children are, it's not inclusive of our history, and I'm able to teach him about, you know, great African kingdoms and people like Denmark VC who fought against slavery and those sorts of people, people that he otherwise wouldn't have heard about because the curriculum does not include us and does not give us a starting point for greatness whereby he can take into his life later on and understand that we were a lot more than slaves.
Now, tell us about what the impact this has had on you.
It has not impacted me the way I thought it would. He's in high school and is able to do a lot of his learning autonomously. If at any time it does interfere with my work, I will rather change my work and figure that out as opposed to putting him back into the dangers of the public school system.
And are seeing, actually my interest in this started with a Facebook conversation I saw friends of mine having about, specifically about Black families beginning to do more homeschooling. Are you personally seeing other Black families or families of color more broadly considering taking your cue and homeschooling their kids?
I absolutely am. And I actually got the motivation from someone that I know who was homeschooling. I know a lot of Black families who are homeschooling and a lot more who are, you know, just starting their families and intend to homeschool. Yeah.
And how's your son doing?
He's faring really well because I'm able to give him that one-on-one attention and really make sure that he's thriving and ingesting everything that he's learning.
Melody, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Melody Cunningham in Weymouth, Massachusetts. Precise data on this is hard to pin down, but some estimates put the number of homeschooled African-American children in the United States at around 136,000, or about 8% of the total homeschooled population. And some research says those numbers are on the rise. Donna Y. Ford is with me now, and she's going to help us put all of this into context. She's a professor and endowed chair at Vanderbilt's Peabody College of Education. Donna, welcome.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Well, let's go to the beginning, or let's go back historically. Why have Black families chosen homeschooling historically?
I think homeschooling is relatively new to Black families compared to white families. And I believe that it relates to opportunity and resources. So Black families tend to be lower income compared to white families, have different occupations and different educational levels. So when you don't have as many resources, it's going to make it very difficult for you to homeschool your child. You just won't have that opportunity. So, for example, my grandson is 6 years of age, and he's in a parochial school. We chose not to put him in a public school for some of the reasons we'll be talking about. But if my son had the opportunity, he would probably homeschool my grandson, but his occupation prohibits that.
So let's talk a little bit about why there are more Black families homeschooling today than there have been in the past. What are some of the drivers of that trend?
So in the reports that I've been reading, about 80% of families, and I'm just talking about families in general, say they homeschool their children because of issues around safety, peer pressure, things like that. And that is definitely an issue for African Americans too. But I'm going to use one word that I think describes why Black families tend to homeschool their children, and that's racism, discrimination in school settings.
And that type of discrimination could range from the use of language or, I mean, we've seen data that even shows higher rates of school discipline towards Black students. Are those the things that you're referring to?
Those are the things I'm referring to. So, for example, I was looking at a video of a 10-year-old. This was a couple of days ago, 10-year-old Black male, whose teacher told him that when he is 16 and the police shoot him, it will be, or kill him, I believe she said, it will be his own fault. I have concerns about teachers who have used the N-word with too many Black students. Then there's also offensive lesson plans, especially those regarding slavery. So all of this, miseducation with the curriculum, discrimination by teachers, takes a psychological toll on our Black students. And we feel that we have to remove them from school settings. And I want to be clear about not just things like name-calling and miseducation with the curriculum. Black students are significantly underrepresented in gifted programs. So the most recent data from the Office for Civil Rights shows that Black students are 15.5% of our public schools, but only 9.9% of gifted programs. Black students are the most underrepresented in gifted education. And you mentioned discipline a few minutes ago. We are disciplined for subjective reasons. We get disciplined because of our hairstyle, the clothes we wear. There's research saying we get disciplined, meaning suspended also at disproportionate rates for skin tone, body, and, you know, the way we speak. I have to share this piece of data because I think it'll create another sense of urgency and clarify even more why Black families are increasingly homeschooling. Black boys are 19% of the preschool population. However, they are 52% of all suspensions. No one could possibly deny that discrimination is not in effect. It is impossible to have those numbers without there being discrimination. Our children overall are suspended 3 times more than white children. And just as problematic, we are 2 to 3 times overrepresented in certain categories of special education. So this underrepresentation in gifted and overrepresentation for special education and discipline creates a sense of urgency and desperation among Black families to say we've got to save our children from the educational system and homeschool our children ourselves.
And is this empowering for Black communities and Black parents, or is it adding more stress to an already stressful situation, and is it letting public schools off the hook?
I think it is empowering when you have the means and are able to homeschool your child. I think if you really don't have the means, but you make that necessary sacrifice, you know, have to give up some things so that you can make homeschooling possible, it definitely adds stress. And then the last part of your question was, I forgot.
Are we letting public schools off the hook by really doing the job that they should be doing?
I think we are letting schools off the hook when we have to resort to homeschooling to get our children a high quality education. And by letting them off the hook, I'm saying we are not holding them responsible and accountable for doing what is their job, and that is to educate children. So instead of fixing the problem, yes, I believe we're running away from the problem when we decide to homeschool our children, but we don't want our children to be sacrificial lambs either. And that goes back to my grandson. I am a product of public schools. I'm a proponent of public schools. But until I know that my grandson is going to get a rigorous education, I can't put him in the surrounding public schools. So I have to pay for him to get a high-quality, rigorous education.
Donna Y. Ford is a professor and endowed chair at Vanderbilt's Peabody College of Education. Donna, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
My name is Patrick in Austin. My wife and I have strongly considered homeschooling, as we've both taught in the public school system and feel that the current system is not at all focused on what is best for the students and lacks accountability for students who disrupt others' learning. Unless the system has changed pretty dramatically, we will likely homeschool.
Hi, my name is Tina. I'm calling from St. Louis, Missouri. I homeschooled my daughter during high school. She had multiple health problems, including severe chronic pain, and the school did not understand the challenges her health presented. And homeschooling allowed us the flexibility we needed when she was hospitalized, which was hundreds of times, and when her pain was so severe, she couldn't move.
Join the conversation on The Takeaway's Facebook page or send us a tweet at The Takeaway.
Hey, thanks for checking out The Takeaways podcast. And if you like what you hear, why not help spread the word? You leaving us a rating or a review on iTunes will definitely help us stand out from the pack. Thanks in advance. Now back to the show.
Tanzina Vega back with you on The Takeaway. And, you know, a lot of our gun violence segments start with the phrase, in the wake of. And honestly, sadly, it feels like we're constantly in the wake of some kind of shooting from our streets to our classrooms. And this week, we've been exploring how parents are approaching having the gun talk with their kids. And you, our listeners, had a lot to say.
My name's Haley. I'm calling from Lakeland, Florida. I have a 7-year-old in first grade. And he initiates the talk with me because he goes through the drills, and he has been doing this since he started school. So it's very disconcerting, a bit of a loss of what to do and how to help him feel safe in school.
My name is Amanda. I'm calling from Suffolk County, New York. I spoke to my 5-year-old about guns and about the drills going on at his school that, you know, bad people had come into schools and, you know, shot at people, and people got very hurt. So about 2 weeks later, he told another student in the playground that he was going to bring in a gun and shoot them. And I don't believe he knows anything about what he's saying or the implications of it.
But Chris and Nicole Aronson are having a very different conversation about guns in their house. Chris and Nicole live in Harris, Minnesota, population 1,000, about an hour's drive north of Minneapolis. They run an ammunitions making business, JC Arms and Ammunition. They have 2 children, a 7-year-old and a 3.5-year-old. And Chris starts us off with what the gun talk sounds like in their house.
Nicole and I both left our careers approximately 4.5 years ago, and we started a manufacturing company that is related to the firearms industry. So for us, the topic has been something that's in the back of our mind of when do we introduce our young children to this. And for us, the most important thing was when they started to show an interest in what mom and dad's interests were and what we did, then we needed to have that conversation. And to be perfectly fair, when our son turned 5 and he started to have more interactions with his friends from preschool and kindergarten, where there were play dates, where they would be at other people's homes, we didn't exactly know what other families' gun practices were or what their gun storage and safety methods were. So for us, it was very important to have that conversation with our son to make sure that if he's at a friend's house and a friend has access to a firearm, that he knew that that was wrong and that a child or children shouldn't be touching, you know, a firearm. So that's kind of how it started in our house.
And what type of relationship do both of you want your kids to have with guns as they grow up?
Yeah, so the relationship I want my children to have with firearms is a relationship that they're comfortable with. So if at any point in time, who my son is 7 now, he started shooting a rifle, 22 rifle at 5, and at 6 he started shooting a 22 pistol. And if he's comfortable with it and he expresses interest in it and he can follow the instructions and participate in this safely, you know, we'll continue to foster that relationship with the firearm. If at any point in time our son becomes uncomfortable with the firearm, or, you know, he just realizes that it's something that's not for him, then we're just going to emphasize that we support his decision to, you know, not show interest in this and not participate in it. However, we still want him to be very aware that, you know, we live in America. We live in a gun culture country, and, you know, irregardless of what people think, I mean, it's not going to change.
Nicole, did you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I just wanted to add that I grew up in a household that did not have firearms present. My father was a veteran, but chose, as he got out of the military, to not own firearms for whatever the reason. I've never asked him why. So in comparison to Chris's upbringing, we come from very different family backgrounds. And now that I am very familiar with firearms, and, you know, conceal carry every day, I wish I would have learned respect for firearms at a much younger age. The very first time that I ever fired a firearm was as an adult. And I am really taking that to heart when I am raising my own children, because, like Chris said, we live in a very, you know, gun culture society. And at some point in time, unfortunately, our children are going to come across more than likely a dangerous situation where they need to know the dangers. They need to also respect that firearm and know what they're capable of.
And in addition to the gun safety talk, which obviously is important for preventing injuries and other things from happening, have you all talked to the kids about the school shootings or about suicide or about all these other heavier topics that come up when we talk about guns in the United States?
Well, our youngest is 3.5, so the conversation hasn't been raised a whole lot with her because she's too young to really comprehend it. However, she is very aware that her parents both conceal carry a firearm on them every single day, and she knows not to touch it. Our 7.5-year-old, on the other hand, he is in first grade, sees the news, he hears the radio, he's a very intelligent young boy, and he can comprehend that kind of thing when he hears it. So we have had conversations with him because he has asked and he's been curious, and he knows that if he sees something that isn't right at school, that he needs to go to an adult or his teacher immediately.
And when you say see something that isn't right, or do you mean a student that might be of concern or a firearm or what exactly?
So, you know, something that's very important for us is, even though you're 7.5 years old, you know, you're a first grader and you have friends, and you have a responsibility to treat your friends well and to just be a good person. So when we're teaching Evan, our son, how to value relationships and how to respect his friends, and, you know, that kid that's not always picked to play in the sports and the kid who's kind of left out to the side, like, sometimes we need to, you know, open our hearts up and just be kind to that person. Sometimes a simple hello, you know, can prevent somebody from, you know, being bullied or, you know, falling into depression and contemplating suicide or contemplating hurting somebody else. So when we have these gun conversations with our children and we're talking about friendship and guns and seeing something that raises an eyebrow at school, we tie it into just being that human, be kind, you know, be open to people, be gentle, reach out to that kid that doesn't seem like he has that friend. You know, you don't have to be his friend, but sometimes just say hi to that kid.
And Chris, I'm just curious, and Nicole, I'm wondering, as you're talking about compassion, is Evan affected by any of the school shootings? Does he fear what could happen going to school?
Evan and I have had the conversation as well as with Nicole, and Evan has brought up that, you know, it's scary that somebody can do that, but, you know, he understands that statistically, you know, these things are few and far between, even though how horrific they are. So he asked, well, you know, if we took all the guns away, don't you think this would happen still? And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, there's other ways to hurt people. And, you know, so it's like, wow, you're 7.5 years old and you understand, you know, if somebody's going to do something bad, they're going to find a way to do something bad.
And in terms of, I mean, we know that it's not just guns that are creating this scenario, particularly when it comes to school shootings. We're going to be talking about this a lot on the show in the upcoming days. They're largely young men who are committing these shootings, and they've either had access to be able to buy guns or they've gotten guns from their homes. Is that an issue of American culture? Is it an issue of lack of parental guidance, or is it something deeper?
I think a lot of it starts with parenting. And quite frankly, children under the age of 18 in the household should not have access to the firearm. They shouldn't know codes, the safes. All firearms should be, you know, in personal safes and locked. There really shouldn't be, you know, anyone under 18 that should have access to any of their parents' weapons without parental supervision.
I agree with Nicole. I mean, you know, I unequivocally support the Second Amendment. I served my country over a 22-year period, both with the military and in the human intelligence sector on the federal side. And I believe that, you know, this is our fundamental right as a U.S. citizen. However, I really do think that there's a lack of accountability for gun storage. If somehow your child under the age of 18 gets unsupervised access to your firearms, you should be held accountable by the court system. You know, we hear it, you know, a dozen times a year on the news. Those parents should be prosecuted. There's no reason whatsoever that a child should have access to a firearm unsupervised and at home. But then if you look at Parkland, you look at Sandy Hook. Sandy Hook, you know, is a prime example. That child was so intent on committing that crime that he murdered his mother, and then he broke into the family safe to access those firearms. He committed multiple crimes before he did that. Parkland, you know, 25 plus times local law enforcement had to interact with this kid in regards to some sort of mental health behavior and wellness checks by, you know, called in by family and, you know, adults that were in charge of supervising him. That kid down in Parkland should have never had access to that firearm.
Chris and Nicole, we've been hearing from parents all week, and we've been talking to them about this really difficult topic. And I want to play you both a cut from an interview that I did with a father. His name is David Kotke, and he's the father of a 7-year-old child in Colorado. And here's what he had to tell us.
Gun culture in America is pretty much just gotten out of control. It's a braggadocious type thing where people like to brag about their guns. They like to put stickers on their cars with assault rifles and NRA. And, you know, I think it's just an utter lack of respect for life. And, you know, people value their guns and their rights to own any kind of weapon they want over human life.
Would either of you care to comment on that?
Well, I think that, you know, there's certain aspects of the gun culture that are a little bit braggadocious. Gun owners are proud people. You know, they, from our experience, you know, a lot of gun owners, you know, interpret the Constitution as we do, and they understand the sacrifice that it's taken, you know, to bring America to the point that it's at. But the thing is right now is the NRA is a privately funded entity paid for by the donations of people who want to protect their gun rights. I'm an NRA life member. My wife is an NRA life member. Our company is an NRA, you know, business partnership. I don't necessarily believe in everything that the NRA stands for. I think the NRA needs to make some moves. I think that the change in leadership at the NRA is slowly starting to happen. And we're going to see, you know, some really good things come out of the NRA, not just for gun owners, but for all Americans. And then, you know, we keep hearing the word assault rifle perpetuated in all facets of media. I'll listen to Fox News. I'll listen to NPR. I'll listen to a little bit of, you know, CNN. It's almost like we live in a different universe when you take those three entities and you compare the topics and then the way that guns are spoken about. When we're not willing to properly discuss what these inanimate objects are and the responsibility in owning them, if we just want to put these big labels out there, tell people that NRA, you know, members have blood on their hands. They celebrate, you know, when children are shot. They, you know, gun industry companies, you know, enjoy mass shootings because they make profits. We've been in this industry for nearly 5 years. I don't know a single NRA member who's ever been nothing but sad by any shooting. And I just don't know any industry companies that take solace in the fact that somebody got hurt and now they're going to profit. I mean, you know, the biggest thing I think is we need to check our emotions and we all need to come to the table and we need to have rational conversations.
Chris and Nicole Aronson are husband and wife and founders and owners of JC Arms and Ammunitions in Minnesota. Chris and Nicole, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Join the conversation on The Takeaway's Facebook page or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for talking with me today. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.